From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Bush administration named the war Operation Iraqi Freedom. And the fundamental assumption of the invasion was that Iraqis would see it that way too and rejoice and rise up. They may still. They surely want to put the tyrant behind them. But there is a foreign army on their soil. Tonight on Point, how Iraqis see the American invasion, liberation or conquest, and the implications of their view. We begin in northern Iraq, where last night 1,000 U.S. paratroopers jumped onto a key airfield, perhaps as a prelude to opening a northern front. And today, for the first time, Iraqi troops in the north retreated under American bombardment and Kurdish troops pushed south and west. Charles Sennett is a correspondent with the Boston Globe in northern Iraq. I asked him to explain the latest news in the north.
Well, the big development was that the Kurdish forces noticed that the Iraqi military up on a ridgeline here in Chamchamal, which is a border town right along the Kurdish-controlled zone and the Saddam Hussein-controlled rest of Iraq, they noticed that the positions were abandoned. So they pushed forward pretty tentatively at first and took the checkpoint on the road and then met no resistance and just pushed in. And they've gone in about 18 kilometers or at least 12 kilometers into Saddam Hussein-held part of Iraq. So that's the first time we've seen the Kurdish forces actually push past the line, and it seems like the northern front is really gaining some momentum now.
But, Charlie, what does this suggest? You've quoted Kurdish leaders saying they need a lot more heavy equipment to go into the real population centers there, Mosul and Kirkuk, the big oil center. Even now, with the new U.S. troops in there last night, they have nothing near enough to go after those cities, do they?
No, they don't. I think what it suggests is the chaos and confusion of this whole front line. The north has been very isolated. It's also been very stalled because of the Turkish government's decision not to allow the 60,000 U.S. combat troops to come through to do a major offensive. There's kind of a feeling of chaos along the border, and I think what happened tonight was the Iraqi soldiers have just been pounded by U.S. airstrikes along the ridge, and they ran for their lives, basically. And we had a situation where the PUK, one of the militia groups here, just seized the opportunity and pushed forward. So it'll be interesting to see to what extent the air power continues to force a retreat. And frankly, you know, to what extent the U.S. will tolerate the PUK forces or the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan forces moving further and further into Saddam Hussein-controlled Iraq.
What's the American concern there, Charlie?
One would be Turkey. Turkey has insisted that the Kurdish forces should not get to Kirkuk and try to take control of that city.
With its oil wealth.
Right. It has some of the most vast oil wells in Iraq, so it's coveted for its oil. It's also coveted by the Kurds because it's a part of their history and their tradition, and they see it really as the heart of the Kurdish areas of the north. But there is also a Turkoman community that was there since the Ottoman Empire, and Turkey feels very protective of those Turkoman because they are ethnically Turk.
Charlie Sennett, what are you hearing from in that area, from in Kirkuk itself?
We've heard a lot of things because we've been able to get some phone calls into Kirkuk, and it sounds like a pretty horrifying place to be right now, especially if you're Kurdish. The Iraqi military and the Mukhabarat, or the kind of intelligence agency of the Iraqi military, which is very feared and loathed, is everywhere in the streets. They're armed, and they have bullhorns where they're basically telling people that if you come out of your homes, you will be shot on sight. We've also had reports of 61 people being executed en masse on one occasion approximately a week ago, and reports from inside that 1,500 men suspected of being part of an underground opposition have been loaded onto buses and taken to an unknown location. So there's very much a sense of the regime trying to keep an uprising from happening in Kirkuk.
On another front, Charlie Sennett, what about this Ansar al-Islam group that the U.S. has linked to al-Qaeda or has claimed has links to al-Qaeda? There have been reports that they've been bombed as well and U.S. special forces in the vicinity of those 600 men.
You're right. That's a whole separate war almost up here. There are U.S. special forces who have moved up there. There are about 6,000 Kurdish forces all preparing for a major offensive on Ansar al-Islam. But the real issue with Ansar is this surrender offer. Just yesterday, they made an offer for amnesty for Ansar al-Islam, and they're giving that a day for those fighters who will come out. Very few are expected to accept the amnesty offer. And then what promises to be a very brutal offensive will get underway, which will include not only the airstrikes, which have been going on for a while, but also a ground offensive, and really trying to finish them off, frankly. I think it's going to be very messy and very bloody when this front starts up, and that's expected within the next, say, 48 hours or so.
And Charlie Sennett, sitting back for a moment, I realize you're looking at many different groups there, but there is this question of how U.S. forces in Iraq are being received.
It's hard for me to say because, you know, we're not inside Saddam Hussein-controlled Iraq. We're in the Kurdish zone. And tonight, for example, there was this chaotic scene as the Kurdish forces pushed inside to Saddam Hussein-controlled Iraq of celebrations. You know, the Peshmerga, as they're called, which means those who face death, the proud Kurdish fighters, were shooting their guns in the air and celebrating and saying, we'll be in Kirkuk tomorrow. And so here you feel a tremendous sense of celebration just by going in a few kilometers into Saddam Hussein-controlled Iraq. We also had a pretty wild evening in the sense that there were two Iraqi soldiers who had walked down from that hillside and surrendered themselves to some local Kurdish fighters, actually into the house where we've been staying. And they said basically their colleagues in the Iraqi army are desperate to surrender. 90% of them want to just run down that hill. But there are execution squads that are accompanying the Iraqi military and will shoot them if they try to run. So they've been afraid to do that. But we're going to begin, I think, now to see more and more of those soldiers trying to defect.
Charlie Sennett, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to talk to you, Tom.
Charles Sennett is a correspondent with the Boston Globe. He spoke with us from Chamchamal, a northern town on the border of Kurdish-controlled Iraq. Last Friday, just 2 days into the war in Iraq, a young U.S. Marine lowered the Iraqi flag and raised the Stars and Stripes over the southern Iraqi port of Qasr. American troops had faced tougher resistance than they had expected that day. It seemed only natural to raise Old Glory when the port was taken. But almost as soon as the U.S. flag went up, the Marines were told to take it down. It sends the wrong message, their higher-ups said. American troops are a liberation force, not a conquering one. It was a small incident at the beginning of what looks to be a longer, tougher war than expected, but it points to an unexpectedly troubling issue. What if the Iraqi people won't or can't greet U.S. troops as liberators? What if Iraqis trapped so long under Saddam Hussein's brutal regime somehow come to see this war not as one of liberation, but of conquest? Iraqis may still rise up, throw off the dictator, and swing open the gates of Baghdad to U.S. troops, but they haven't yet. And every moment that they don't has deep implications for this war now and for the shape of a post-war Iraq. Did you expect garlands for U.S. troops in Iraq? Is it fear and the iron fist of Saddam holding Iraqis down even now? Or could there be real broad ambivalence about the foreign troops on Iraqi soil? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Ahmed Al-Rahim. He's an Iraqi-American and teaches at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard University. Good evening and welcome, Ahmed Al-Rahim.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. And with us from Philadelphia, Ian Lustig, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and editor of Right Sizing the State, the Politics of Moving Borders. Good evening and welcome, Ian Lustig.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. And from Hanover, New Hampshire is On Point's news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
And so here we are. Ahmed Al-Rahim, I'll turn to you first. I think it was very widely expected by Americans, and certainly it has been the picture portrayed by President Bush and all the Bush administration from very early on, that U.S. troops would be seen as liberators. It makes perfect sense. It's logical. I think most Americans would expect it. We've heard for years about how terrible, how brutal, how vicious, how cruel this regime is. And yet, in these early days of the war, we haven't seen quite the displays that were anticipated.
reading the New York Times today, John Kiffner describing Marines talking about their advance through Iraq being contested every inch, every mile on the way up, a kind of rethinking of the assumption that uprisings by the civilian population would be a key element of what's going on in Iraq. We just don't know how to interpret this, and we're hoping you can take us some margin into the minds of what Iraqis may be thinking. We acknowledge it's very, very difficult from outside. We acknowledge that there is still, as the reporter Charlie Sennett with the Boston Globe pointed out at the top of the hour, Saddam's forces in the military and among civilian populations still intimidating and menacing. But how is there a chance that there's a kind of Iraqi nationalism behind all this that may inhibit or diminish the reception that American troops get as they move deeper into Iraq?
Well, I think that there is a kind of nationalism that is there within the troops that are fighting the U.S. Saddam's troops, and what I would say about the Iraqi people is that I think that they perceive the U.S. in general as liberators. At this point, I mean, we're in the middle of the war. It's very difficult to tell what's going to happen, and I think the Iraqis are a bit ambivalent about standing up and taking over cities and fighting the troops, because in 91, as we remember, they did just that, and they were not supported by the U.S. They were, in fact, put down brutally. So till they see some signs that Saddam is teetering in Baghdad, I don't think they're going to rise up.
But you're saying behind that ambivalence, or maybe more accurately, fear, you anticipate a readiness to see American troops as liberators?
I would say that once Baghdad is liberated, once Saddam is toppled, I say that Iraqis will actually come out in support of U.S. troops. At this point, it is very difficult to tell because there are many Iraqis being killed in these cities by Saddam's troops, by bombs that have fallen in civilian areas. And so they're a bit hesitant. They do not know what to do.
Ian Lustig, what's your reading here? So much seems to ride on this, and it's the worst sort of nightmare to imagine winning the war but then being seen as conquering occupiers and not liberators on the other side. Do you have any fear of that?
Well, of course. I think that's the main thing we have to be concerned about, and I think it's going to be extremely difficult as time goes on after the military victory to prevent what initial good feelings may exist from turning into what would be a more normal Middle Eastern Muslim Arab resentment of being occupied by an outside power. Saddam is a monster, but at least he was our monster may well become the slogan. But I'd like to go back to the question of 1991, which was raised, because I think that President Bush may inadvertently be telling the Iraqi people not to revolt. In 1991, we basically said, revolt. We need you to revolt if you want to be free. Mm-hmm. So although it was dangerous to revolt, the Iraqi Shia and the Kurds thought it was necessary. So they did, and they were slaughtered. This time, if you listen to the president's news conference today, over and over again, he emphasized that no matter what, we are going to get rid of Saddam. It doesn't matter what happens. In effect, it doesn't matter what the Iraqi people do, the United States and Britain are going to get rid of Saddam. So it's now being said that although it's still dangerous to revolt, it's no longer necessary. So you don't really have to know too much about the day-to-day opinions of Iraqis. Just rely on a little common sense that in this situation, if you're going to be told that Saddam is going to be eliminated no matter what you do, and it's dangerous too early raise your head, just keep your head down and wait, which is, I think, what most people will try to do.
Ian Lustig, Ahmed Al-Rahim, and Jack Beattie, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about how Iraqis see the U.S. invasion force as liberators or conquerors and the implications of those perceptions. Is it possible to know now how Iraqis perceive the American military in their midst? Is it fear of Saddam Hussein and his supporters that's keeping down that uprising? Is it, as Ian Lustig suggests, the promise of an American president that American forces will do it for them? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking tonight about how Iraqis see the U.S. invasion force now in their midst as liberators or as conquerors and the implications of their perceptions. Is it possible to know now how Iraqis perceive those troops? And are Iraqis just too scared to throw flowers now? Are they waiting for Americans to do the job? I'm joined in the studio tonight by Ahmed Al-Rahim, an Iraqi-American. He teaches at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard University. And from Philadelphia by Ian Lustig. He's professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Ian Lustig mentioned, and as did Ahmed Al-Rahim, President George Bush I, George H.W. Bush, in 1991, his call to Iraqis to stand up and throw over the Saddam Hussein regime.
Compliance with the resolutions will instantly stop the bloodshed. And there's another way for the bloodshed to stop, and that is for the Iraqi military and the Iraqi people to take matters into their own hands and force Saddam Hussein, the dictator, to step aside.
There it is, 1991, President George H.W. Bush, father of the sitting president. And of course, many Iraqis did follow that call. I think 14 of 18 provinces had uprisings. The United States did not come to their aid. They were brutally suppressed. This time, Jack Beatty, just today, George W. Bush was saying, we will push this dictator out no matter how long it takes. Is it possible, as Ian Lustig says, that Iraqis have already read that message in this administration and that part of the kind of muted response U.S. troops are seeing is them hunkering down, still under threat from the regime, and waiting for American troops to do the job?
That makes eminent good sense to me, but consider this. Ann Garrels did a piece on this network last night, and it was about the bombing in the Market Square in Baghdad. Mm. And someone came up to her holding a severed human hand and said, is this liberation? And someone else came up with a can with some human brains in it and said, is this human rights? Now, you said time. Mr. Bush says however long it takes. Well, consider this. Who's a Fedayeen fighter and who's a civilian? I mean, how are they going to tell? Civilian buses turning out to be troop transports, guerrillas clustered near schools and hospitals, people pretending to surrender and then ambushing. Imagine weeks of urban combat. Imagine what that will do. And imagine the pictures that will give the world, and imagine the state of the Iraqi hearts and minds as they're being liberated, some of them into their deaths, and others facing the fact that this liberation has been a kind of destruction. And I think this is this time element here, and the notion of sieges of city is a way in which we can take this undoubted feeling of wanting to be rid of this monster and make ourselves the monster.
Ahmed Al-Rahim, how about it? We are on the path of war. We are in war. War is messy, bloody, deadly, and it's clear that there will be civilian casualties. It has not gone as quickly as some had hoped. The president saying today it may stretch out for a long time. How do you think the chemistry of Iraqi thinking may percolate under this more extended attack? Will they wait patiently in their heart of hearts, whatever public face they have to show, for American troops to throw out this regime? Is it possible that they could actually be soured during a war against the very force that has come, right up front under a banner of liberation?
I mean, I think it's possible that certain Iraqis will be soured and others will, in their heart of hearts, wait for liberation. So you will have all these feelings there in Iraq and these kinds of reactions. I think what the thing to understand is Saddam is trying to draw the U.S. troops into urban combat. I mean, we have reports of Fidayeen going into residential areas and taking up residence. In fact, I've talked to family in Iraq, and so far they have said that bombing has been targeting government buildings and institutions. But what they are worried about is these Saddam's troops moving into the neighborhoods and taking up residence. So I think I have to say that I mean, I knew that this was going to be messy business all along. It's not going to be an easy liberation. Saddam is in Baghdad, and he has his troops there, and it's going to be messy business. And I think we have some terrible days ahead.
Ian Lustig, what about this idea of Iraqi nationalism? I suppose in any country, there's got to always be ambivalence about foreign troops in large numbers on your soil, perhaps even when there's a local dictator. But what do we know, what do you know about the character, the quality of Iraqi nationalism? Can you imagine in this cauldron of war, the population or major portion of it going south on the U.S., being soured on the U.S. military out of a nationalistic kind of response?
Well, there are any number of nationalistic responses. I mean, Iraqi nationalism per se is not necessarily that strong a force, but each group in Iraq, the Sunni Muslims, the Kurds, and the Turkomans and so on, they have their own political ambitions. If we eventually do manage to set up some kind of a democratic regime, and Iraq is anything like any other Middle Eastern Muslim country, it's almost certain that the Muslims would win such elections. It's not clear that we would like that or allow it. We heard from our Secretary of State yesterday that the United States is not fighting this war to give up a controlling, dominating role in Iraq. That is, we are going to insist on that.
To the UN or anybody else?
That's right. So I would suggest a kind of phases approach to the question of, as you put it, the percolation of opinion. Hmm. First, we have a war, and I've suggested that the Iraqi people are hunkering down and just waiting. But at a certain point when it's very clear the regime is collapsing, there'll be what we call in political science a cascade of activity as everyone seeks to establish their record as having been on the winning side, just like in France after World War II, all of a sudden everybody was in the resistance, even though it might have been only for a week before the liberation. And then right after the end of the regime, we can expect a very brief period of roses when each group that thinks it could benefit by being associated with the United States comes forward with fulsome praise. But then realities will set in. That's the reality phase, when the tough divisions and internecine hatreds and contradictions of interest by the United States and the local population come back to haunt us and them. And then the final phase, and in that phase, the Iraqi population will start using the obvious templates and analogies, just like we use World War II whenever we go to war and say our enemy is like Hitler. In the Middle East, if you're invaded, it's either like the British and the French occupying Egypt during the Suez War of 1956, which produced a maelstrom of support for Nasser across the Arab world, or it's Beirut occupied by Israel in 1981, where the Israelis set up what they thought was a good regime. The leader was assassinated. They were forced out 17 years later.
But what about the model that the White House has alluded to? Neither of those, but rather post-World War II, Japan and Germany.
Well, I think it's very – if you think clearly about those cases, they're not at all comparable. But the United States government does spin a story about what Iraq is going to look like that you can't prove is wrong, because the laws of the universe don't forbid the idea that the United States can groom a prosperous, dynamic democracy in Iraq that will be allowed to prosper after the Americans totally leave, and that there won't be widespread bloodshed and territorial integrity. We can't prove that's not wrong. But it's like predicting that a particular baseball player who's doing extremely well in spring training will bat 450 this year, when we know it's never been done. It's not impossible, but what the United States is saying it's going to do in Iraq has never been done in the Middle East by a great power. Every imperialist power, whether it went into Egypt or Algeria or Tunisia or Morocco or Iraq, for that matter, has not been able to do what the United States says it's going to do.
Jack Beatty, I heard you earlier talking about an interview that you had seen. I think it was Bob Simon with CBS talking to a Shia leader about U.S. troops and exactly this issue of when the U.S. is welcome and when it's not.
Yeah, Bob Simon had spent a week or so in Iran with the Iraqi Shiite opposition parties there. And I think there may even be some sort of militia. And he was talking to these people, and I think he was talking to one of their leaders, and he said, this man said, we want Saddam gone, and then we want you gone the next day.
I.e. the U.S. gone the next
US
day, right behind Saddam.
And this is this, you know, the group that is most disaffected from Saddam. You mentioned the repression in 1991. And Simon was saying, this, you know, here's the ambivalence. We want him gone, but we don't want you here for any longer than you need to be. But with this this Shiite leader, it sounded like, you know, you had about a day and a half. And, you know, this has happened before. It isn't, you know, in our last spasm of democratic imperialism, and it was called just that, in 1899-1902, we went out and took a country, the Philippines. And at that time, there was a nationalist revolt going against a colonial government. So it was even worse than this in the sense that there were people of another ethnicity who were ruling over the Filipinos. And we came and we chased the Spanish out and then fastened ourselves onto the Philippines and crushed and immediately turned the Filipino people against us and embarked on a war of genocidal proportions that killed 250,000 Filipinos, maybe more. And it has everlastingly disgraced this country. And we didn't get out of that country until 1946. My point is, we went out there with all the great motives in the world. McKinley said we're going to, you know, stabilize them and then give them liberty and give them good government. And when we were there, we discovered, well, maybe we'll stay a while. The strategic outlook out here looks pretty good. We could keep an eye on the French, on the Germans, and the China. We could, you know, get into the imperialist game ourselves. And it had all these justifications. We had a yellow press then, just as we do now. We have a yellow network now saying, oh, how good you were, how wonderful. And we had a president who wasn't exactly sophisticated about these things. Mr. Dooley said of Mr. McKinley that he wasn't sure whether the Philippines was a country or some canned goods.
Well, it's certainly not the way this is being advertised. Bob's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, thanks.
It seems to me that this war on the cheap that Rumsfeld's running is quite a bit different than the 91 war, where the Iraqis basically laid themselves out to be destroyed by our Air Force. But this time it appears as if someone read Sun Tzu's Art of War and is actually using the strength of a weak country against a very strong one. Witness what's happening to our supply lines.
But in that context, Bob, can you imagine Iraqi civilians being ambivalent about the troops that have been sent and advertised as loud as Washington can advertise it, sent to liberate them from a very cruel dictator?
I don't want to make this analogy too strong, but when the Nazis actually invaded Russia, Stalin basically received tremendous support from the people of Russia because they felt that they were being invaded and they didn't have much choice. To a great extent, Stalin was obviously a greater monster than Saddam Hussein is. I think that, to a certain extent, is partly what we're seeing. We're not viewed, I think, as a liberating country. We're viewed basically as one that's conquering it.
Bob, thanks for your call. Ahmed Al-Rahim, is it over-the-top kind of nightmare thinking to imagine Iraqis actually rallying around Saddam Hussein in the metaphor, the parallel that Bob draws here very loosely with Stalin? I mean, is that even imaginable?
I think Iraqis wouldn't do that. I think there are certain segments within the military that do that. The Fideen are playing a large part in trying to rally Iraqis.
These are core loyalists, and rally may be a generous word. I mean, we're hearing these descriptions of people, soldiers being pushed into battle at gunpoint, of people being told if they go out in the street, they'll be shot on sight, civilians.
The young men in the cities are being rounded up and being taken, used as human shields. They're being rounded up and recruited for the Fideen and for fighting this war. In fact, there are reports that some Fideen have put on American uniforms and have gone out to see if Iraqis will surrender. And once they do, they would shoot them on the spot.
That doesn't sound good. And what about Ian Lustig's concerns about the day after an American victory? I mean, we really have a couple of phases here, and I want to go back to the military, but we have the clear and public expectation of, for a brief time, military rule. Washington is resisting the United Nations. It is for the benefit of Iraq, George Bush says again and again. Iraq for Iraqis, Iraqi oil for Iraqis. Can you imagine Iraqis accepting that?
I think the important thing and is that the U.S. began to use Iraqis on the ground, that there are many in the opposition who are willing to go in and fight. I think what needs to happen is there were Iraqis that were trained in Hungary that need to be put on the ground. So the U.S. strategically, I think, has to put an Iraqi face to this, especially in the post-Saddam Iraq. If they don't, you're going to have this kind of opposition, particularly from someone like Mohammed, from Baqir al-Sadr, the Iranian, who's in Iran.
The Shia leader that Jack cited earlier,
who's in Iran, right? He, I think, will come in and try to create problems for the U.S. So it's important that they put an Iraqi face to a post-Saddam Iraq.
Winston's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Winston. You're on the air. Hello, Winston. Are you there?
Yes.
Hi.
Thank you. You know, let me make the standard disclaimer first. Saddam, I think, has been sadistic, and his time, I believe, has come. Even the Iraqi people think so. But having said that, let me say this. I think the American public, the press particularly, have not really shown what the Iraqi people have been thinking. They have the memories of the 91 war, its legacy, and then they hear all the stories in this country where contracts are being given out, and then they're probably wondering if their oil wealth is going to be distributed out.
These are contacts for post-war reconstruction.
Right. I mean, the other thing is the flag that was planted the other day.
In Umkasa.
Right. And also when they look at some place like Yugoslavia, which has gone from what was then a kind of a status system into a fully capitalist system where prices have gone up. The ordinary Iraqi may say, yes, I don't like this dictator, this brutal person, but is it going to mean that our whole way of life is going to change unimaginably?
But would they rather continue to have Saddam Hussein than take a chance on an economy, even if American corporations are involved, even if some of the political ideas are not fully familiar?
Let me say this. You know, perhaps people do not that they need a brutal guy like Saddam there, but perhaps people do not need to have the right to vote as much as having a steady supply of food and shelter and schools and medical services, as was in the case of, Singapore, which doesn't have full democratic rights, but yet they have a very high standard of living. And I think the people are not are pretty happy. I can't speak about the Iraqi people.
Winston, we've got to take a break. We take your point. We'll soon see exactly how this turns out. We're talking tonight about how Iraqis see the U.S. invasion force as liberators or, unthinkably, as conquerors, and the implications of their perceptions. Did you expect uprisings and hosannas, garlands for the troops? Have you seen what you expected? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about how Iraqis see the U.S. invasion force as liberators or conquerors and the implications of their perceptions. Can you imagine, after all these years of Saddam's oppression, that U.S. troops would not be received as liberators? Are Iraqis just too scared to throw flowers? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight from Pennsylvania, joining us from Philadelphia, Ian Lustig, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. And here with me in the studio tonight, Ahmed Al-Rahim, an Iraqi-American, teaches at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard University. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. Amin is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Good evening, Amin.
Hello. Thanks again for the great programs that you're putting on to let us think orthogonally on the main topics here, Tom. But
thanks, Amin.
I'm just wanted to make a comment. I think we're somewhat not seeing the main point here. I think We are telling the people of the region to do what I'm telling you, but don't do as I'm doing myself.
What do you mean exactly? I mean
we have not had a good history anywhere in the world, frankly, or many places in the world, in putting in popular governments. And I think we are kind of swinging back to the 50s model of installing the Shah of Iran and then the Chilean deals and so on.
But we certainly supported the emergence of democratic governments in Japan and Germany after World War II. We put a lot of money into the reconstruction of Europe. I mean, it's not as though there aren't examples.
There are examples, but I think the circumstances have been quite different. Once the Arabian Peninsula was broken off of the Ottoman Empire, the pop culture has become very suspect of foreign intervention, especially that they have not been dealt with on a popular basis. In other words, we have governments in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait, and other places, where by and large they're not popular. They're supported by us. They're paid off by us, and we take them as being friends. And in reality, we have gone into a neighborhood and taken on the toughest foe without really having built credibility elsewhere in the neighborhood.
But, I mean, we saw in 1991 how Iraqis rose up just on the suggestion from afar that they rise up. And surely they must be sick and tired of all the abuses that Saddam Hussein has dished out.
No doubt.
With all of that, the core question we're looking at here tonight is, won't they see the United States as liberators, at least from the imminent threat of a very brutal tyrant?
People have had great casualty as a result of that, and there's an element of disbelief, there's an element of lack of comfort, and it's the pain. The pain is still too near for them to forget, I think. But at the end of the day, the popular media on the other side, on the Iraqi side, plays up to our weaknesses, the fact that we have not been able to support truly an Arab cause in that neighborhood.
I mean, we've got it, and thanks so much for your call. Ian Lustig, do you think that Iraqis are sitting in their homes tonight weighing these issues, saying on the one hand we've got a dictator who slaughters people, on the other hand the United States doesn't have a perfectly lovely record of supporting vigorous democracy in the Middle East. Which way shall we go?
Well, as I said, I think that they're hunkering down now. They, on one level, are thinking that way. And as we move through the phases of this war and then occupation, that thinking will tend to move toward the latter opinion. I'd like to make a comment or two on your reference now a couple times to the German example, that we liberated Germany and built democracy there. Why couldn't we do it in Iraq? Remember that we still have soldiers in Germany. More than 50 years later, our troops are still there.
Are you suggesting that they're necessary to sustain German democracy?
No, I'm not. Mm-hmm. What I'm suggesting is that once we get into a country, the interests that we have get wrapped up in being there, and we don't want to necessarily do what we said we were going to do. So there it was, fighting the Cold War, and we needed Germany to join with us against the Soviet Union. That meant keeping troops there. It also meant allowing tens of thousands of former Nazis to remain in the German government, because it would weaken the government there for us to conduct too thorough a denazification program. And to say nothing, of course, of the scientists who were Nazis that we brought home. So if we were willing to tolerate tens of thousands of former Nazis in the German government, why wouldn't we expect that in the follow-on to Saddam, we're going to allow plenty of people with blood up to their elbows to participate in a regime that we're going to, in Secretary of State Powell's words, control and dominate? I think if there's an assumption in our discussion, and it includes me, that has been challenged in the speaker in the previous caller, and that is, we are wondering why the Iraqis wouldn't see us as liberators when we know we are liberators. But in fact, we may not be, or at least the people in charge of the war may not really be intending to ever leave Iraq. They never spent much time telling us what their exit strategy was. The New American Century Group has published articles talking about the need for global American hegemony.
And there's already quite overt talk about moving U.S. troops out of Saudi Arabia, where that's been problematic, and into a post-war Iraq.
Right.
On the other hand, though, those American forces in Germany hardly dominate Germany today.
They do not. That's right. But Germany is a mammoth country, a superpower economically. Iraq is nothing like that. But Iraq does have one thing Germany does not have: $300 trillion worth of oil. And I can imagine that those are 300 trillion reasons for the United States to find common cause with any element in Iraq that would welcome it staying there.
Ahmed al-Rahim, I keep bringing this back to this to the same question because it seems so urgently important right now. Let's imagine that Iraqis are thinking along these lines. I don't know if they are or not, but one can imagine it. They look out at the world and they see what the world is. Would even this keep them from embracing the immediate liberation from the abuses of the Saddam Hussein regime that the American forces have come to represent?
Look, I think once Baghdad is liberated, Iraqis will come out, and they will not be thinking in terms of alliances, in terms of recognizing Israel, as has been suggested, or any of these things. Iraqis will be thinking about the next day. They will be thinking about getting back to normality. This is going to be the priority for Iraqis.
But could that normality include a U.S., effectively a U.S. military ruler of the country for some time, large U.S. contracts in the reconstruction of the country, even a U.S. military base or bases in Iraq? Could that fit into the picture Iraqis imagine, or could their anticipation or fear of that be so real and acute that even now, in the midst of war, it might lead them to hang back in supporting U.S. troops?
There have been some Iraqis who have been interviewed who have said on the ground there, who have said that they would actually welcome a U.S. occupation, at least in the short term.
Mm-hmm.
Because what has to happen is the opposition, which has generally been outside of Iraq — Saddam has not allowed any opposition to be in Iraq,
to say the least —
has to build a constituency there. And that will take time before there can be a referendum, before there can be elections. And again, the important thing is for the U.S. Army and the U.S. presence there to begin to employ as many Iraqis as possible.
Ayn Lustig, our time is growing short. In the immediate future here, the U.S. military clearly, expressly, was hoping for more Iraqi civilian support than we've seen so far. As U.S. troops cluster around Baghdad and we look at a potential siege, once again, there's the idea that they'll wait on the outside and hope that Iraqis do what needs to be done inside. If that doesn't come, what are the consequences?
Well, the consequences are that we may get into fighting that would produce significant American casualties, possibly, of course, as a result of chemical weapons used against our troops. And if that happens, I am afraid of the political firestorm in this country that could break out, demanding that all possible means be used to defend our troops. That could mean a massive escalation of the war that would involve the equivalent of destroying a city. And if we do that, if we kill that many Iraqi civilians because we can't control our own anger when we're attacked, then we are going to not be able to do what the previous my colleague has suggested is necessary, which is to have a kind of sterile occupation of the country, incubating democracy without generating among the public the feeling that to be associated with the Americans is to be tainted forever in the Iraqi political system.
Well, that is surely a taint that we do not want and do not need right now, with so many U.S. troops there trying to get Saddam Hussein out. Ayn Lustig, our time has come to an end, but thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been great having you.
You're very welcome.
Ayn Lustig is professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. He joined us from Philadelphia. And Ahmed al-Rahim, thank you very much for being with us tonight. It's been great.
Thank you for having me.
Ahmed al-Rahim is an Iraqi-American. He teaches at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard University. Jack, thick undergrowth here. We'd like it nice and clean. We're coming to get rid of the dictator. We'd like open support in that from Iraqi civilians. It may not be that simple.
Well, these are among the things that we haven't, that is, our leadership hasn't thought through, because the whole nature of urban warfare is to inflict casualties on Americans. Americans won't stand that. They will, I think Mr. Lustig really gets it. There'll be demands for escalation. Those demands will result in more Iraqi civilian deaths. Those deaths will not only alienate us from Iraqis, but irretrievably from the good opinion of the world, and especially the Middle East.
We will watch closely, and we will see. Jack, stand by. I want to turn to another element in the news today. Richard Perle resigned today as chairman of the Defense Policy Board, a civilian group that advises the Pentagon. A brief written statement issued by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld did not give a reason for Perle's resignation, although Perle's letter to Rumsfeld mentioned the, quote, controversy surrounding his chairmanship, unquote. The resignation comes 2 weeks after a New Yorker magazine article in which Seymour Hersh detailed Perle's relationship with the controversial Saudi-born businessman Adnan Khashoggi and a Saudi industrialist. Perle has a long history as a Washington hawk during his tenure as Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration. Perle was known as the Prince of Darkness for his hardline stance against nuclear arms control agreements with the former Soviet Union. He played a key role in the Bush administration's policy in Iraq and has been a guest here at On Point. Jack, this is a very interesting step today. There's been a flurry of news coming out about Richard Perle riding the line between private business and his role in advising the U.S. government.
Yes, indeed. And not only the case you mentioned by Seymour Hersh, but another one where he was supposed to get a $725,000 fee from Global Crossing in return for getting them a huge contract.
And with the Pentagon that he was advising.
And the documents from the company, which have come out, have cited his chairmanship of that board as the reason they hired him. But he's not alone. Nine other members of that board have conflicts of interest. That is, they represent companies that do billion-dollar businesses, some of them, with the Pentagon. And meanwhile, what's the biggest conflict of interest at all on the horizon? Halliburton and Brown & Root. Mr. Cheney we're about to give maybe a $1 billion contract to Halliburton. Maxine Waters on the floor of the Senate, on this House the other day, said it would create the appearance that the vice president would be using his position to increase the profits of his company, a company that's very well connected indeed in other ways. So conflict of interest, if we start talking about it, that board is riddled with it, and it seems to me that this Halliburton decision is just rife with it.
But this resignation could indicate, Jack, that the administration is opening eyes to this and stepping back. Maybe we're seeing this as a first sign that they've got to be a little more arm's length business-wise from the policy decisions being made.
But that's against their whole outlook. It's crony capitalism. Remember that all these guys made their piles by working insiders, with government contracts. This is how they see life. The state exists to help the connected.
But it's not only during the Bush administration that the Defense Policy Board has had military-related industries represented. I mean, that's part of the idea, is that they're making a lot of these armaments, and the Pentagon wants to have a way to talk with them.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't have it on my defense policy board. I'd have people from universities. I'd have people from foundations. I'd have people who were clean. But then, of course, that's probably a prehistoric notion of what's possible in government. I just think it stinks that these people who work for private companies are giving advice to the Pentagon. And here we say we have the document from Global Crossing. Why did you hire Mr. Perle? Well, he's the chairman of that committee. That's why we hired him.
Well,
I mean, what could be more blatant?
And tonight, he's standing down. Jack, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Micheline Boudreau and Darren Manoogian. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.